Welcome to Partnerships for Profit, the podcast where we bring you inside the world of joint ventures, strategic partnerships, and powerful collaborations. Whether you're looking to expand your network, find new referral partners, or scale your business, you're in the right place. Let's get started.
On this episode of Partnerships for Profit, we welcome Dr. Rod Berger, PsyD, strategic storyteller, keynote speaker, and media contributor, whose 4,000-plus interviews spans from Magic Johnson to Pope Francis, a TEDx speaker, and a Pangea International Literacy Prize winner. I can't fit all these things in. Rod is known for taking conversations into new and deeper territory, uncovering stories that cut through the noise and connect to the deepest level. So we will be talking about his upcoming book, The Narrative Edge, revealing his authenticity. Unpolished stories often carry more influence than the most polished pitches. That was my most polished version.
I love that, Dean. Thank you very
much. Rod, I'm looking forward to this conversation because, one, just chatting with you before we jumped on was fantastic. Yeah, your personality shines right through the mic. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. No, and likewise, I'm you're very energetic, which is so, you know, because I've been on that side of the mic and it plays very well.
It's a heavy cup, you know? No, I'm just kidding. So give me a quick backstory before we jump into all the brilliancy. What was it about storytelling and these conversations? And I would say probably just pure nosiness as a kid that got you into this line of work.
I love the nosiness. I've not heard that before, but it's so true, right? As a kid, I'm glad you framed it that way. I was always absolutely like just curious about everything.
Yeah.
And I think it was because it was the absence of story.
That's right? Fair.
It wasn't readily available. My late father grew up during World War II in Nazi Germany. And I can say this as a first generation, right? He was sort of classic in his lack of emotive language, right? Yeah. And he traveled all the time. And I remember as a kid, every time he would come back from a work trip, I would go into his bedroom while he was, you know, unpacking, thinking dad's going to share adventures, something,
yeah,
right, outside of suburbia that I was experiencing. And he never did. It was just like, it wasn't important to him in that regard. It wasn't that he was trying to, I guess, push me away, but he just was not a storyteller.
Yeah.
You know, in his world, hope was not something that was ever a part of the calculus, right? Because he had seen just some very awful things. And so all that did was make me even more curious, right? Just it just sort of fed that in that I would be thinking about, like, well, what was it like when he traveled across the world?
Yeah.
And then I think you add that to just being a kid, and kids are curious. They always, you know, why is the question that they sort of, it's the sidecar to their childhood, right? Why? Dean, why did you do this?
Over and over.
Yeah. I know I asked you three times, but I'm wanting another. So it just fed that. And I think that because of that, I had this very, my notion of my dad was heroic in one sense and tragic in the other.
Yeah.
Right. It was this irony of looking up to somebody because he's your dad, but not having a connection. Right. And so almost as if you're watching a movie where you're in the audience and he's up on the screen and yet you're so close, but yet so far, right? This distance that's deep and broad. And so I think you romanticize, right? The travel. I love travel. I had no doubt that came from all those nights wondering what it was like when it was midnight wherever he was and it was lunchtime where I was. And so, you know, you keep that going. And then I had gotten into public speaking because I had an educator that saw something in me and he never sort of asked. He would just tell me, oh, I set you up for this. Now you're going to be doing this. And I'm so glad he did because I probably would have never done half of the things that I did. And I just, you know, Dean, I have been, this is the irony of talking about my father, is that, you know, he'd always accuse me of being a dreamer, which is such an interesting, I think, way to put it, accuse of being a dreamer.
We probably both bought the shirt, right?
Yeah. He wasn't allowed to dream. And yet I have always been, right? It has not wavered at all, right? I'll dream today about things that are going to happen tomorrow or that I hope happen in 2 days. That's just who I am. And, it really drove me to say, well, okay, but what's next, right? I understood what it was like to speak in front of an audience of my peers as a high school student, and then to get paid to do it, which was even wilder, right? Like getting a phone call, like, well, is this hotel okay for you? It's like, I'm 17. I don't know, but it sounds great.
Yeah.
Right. And it just kept going. But I will tell you that from a storytelling perspective, it's one thing to connect to an audience, but I had to learn the lesson that when you connect with an audience, that story has an endpoint. And I wasn't emotionally prepared to connect with audiences and then leave out the back door. And I needed the connection, which is why I said, you know, this may come back in my life at some point in time, but just not now. So, you know, I media was always a part of my life. My initial dream was to be on 60 Minutes because, again, my father, that was a point of connection. We would sit. We wouldn't talk very much, but we would sit and watch 60 Minutes. As a young boy, I would do that. So I knew the world was a big place, sometimes a scary place, and one that needed to be translated, right, in any manner of living. And that's why I went into psychology. And I wanted to understand this. What's the energy between two people in a room, and how do I play a role in hoping to provide some level of assistance?
Right.
But I also knew that that was not going to be my life, right? So I was there to learn everything, soak it up, have these incredible experiences that challenged me. And then I would take that and combine that with my media. And then I'm a glutton for punishment, Dean. I don't take no for an answer. Like, I start reaching out for a podcast guest, you know, like when podcasts just started.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, I got somebody. And then I went, wait a minute. For the next sort of outreach, I should say that I just interviewed Dean, right? And then they say, oh, well, if you interviewed Dean, I guess we could be, you know, and you just start piling it up and you say, oh my gosh, I just did 1500. Oh, I just crossed 2000. Right. And then it just keeps going and going. So,
man,
long way of saying I just, it's a long runway that I've just never said, well, wait a minute, why does it keep going? You know, I just,
this plane will not get off the ground.
I know, but I'm enjoying it. This is a really wonderful pace and the scenery is amazing. So I just keep going.
Yeah, man, it's such an interesting perspective because it, you know, most of us think about, you know, our lack isn't ever the thing that creates in our future, you know, from the mentality of what most people speak about. They're always like, well, you know, you have to create your intention so that you're doing it, not from lack. Yet the lack of storytelling, the lack of connection, the lack of detail in what all was going on in your father's life is literally what brought you into creating all of those imaginary stories in your brain that said, I have to go do these things. And then I think about that of going, now most likely your father flipped to you being a little bit of his hero of all of these things you did that were so probably scary for him. Like that just kind of opens a whole nother door.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's interesting. I, you know, he died years ago, so I don't know sort of at that point what I had achieved or what he might have, you know, how he might have flipped the script.
Yeah.
All I know is that he, you know, he lived in a world where he didn't have time for, let's say, the political side of business or sort of the gamesmanship of adulthood, right? Where sometimes you realize I'm putting my time in right now for a bigger goal or destination.
Yeah.
He didn't have time for that. And so that would be the only thing he would ever talk about, sort of, that I was, he didn't understand my ability to be patient.
Yeah.
And persistent at the same time, right? But that tracked for me because you live in a world where every day is a different day. And he lived in a part of Germany where, depending upon the day, a different country put a flag outside their front door as sort of ownership. And so I think when you grow up in that kind of an environment that's so turbulent, you know, patience is something that runs very thin. And so, yeah, I mean, I would think it would be very interesting to him now, especially the travel piece, because you know, I think he would be blown away about my time at a refugee camp and, you know, studying storytelling in Eastern Africa. I mean, these things are, I know how crazy they sound and how fortunate I am, you know?
Well, and it's, you know, the title, when you give someone and you call them a dreamer, to you, it may sound a little derogatory to an extent, but at the same time, it's like the ability for you to even go there in your mind sounds like, again, just a dream. I was a kid growing up in Louisiana that was like, oh, I'm going to be an actor one day. Sure, buddy.
You know, I love your stuff, Dean. I love your stuff.
It's that same thing where it's like, yeah, you got this. But if you actually follow through, which you did, you know, it becomes a whole nother level of being able to achieve something they, one, just didn't think you could do, and a little bit of fear base. You know, it's like, I love you. I don't want you to go through that pain. That was probably the version of your dad. It was like, I love you, so please don't keep dreaming about this.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong too. I want to make sure that the audience has, you know, I bemoan the people that sort of act as if they were born in the current state that they're in, right? Of accomplishment, of just sense of self and wisdom. Absolutely not. I mean, if you said to me, hey, Rod, let's put together a curriculum for the next generation to, you know, sort of end up maybe where you are, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Boy, I couldn't do that. I mean, it just would be very, very difficult. I mean, there's a lot of happenstance. Now, look, it's how you define luck, right? I mean, are you putting yourself in a position to realize an opportunity because you've put the work in? Maybe, to some extent. I will say that probably that if there's a secret sauce, and it's funny the reaction I get because I think, well, maybe then people don't think this way, is I say yes to almost everything, which I will tell you has, yes, there have been, you know, some backslides to that where I didn't realize it. And there was sort of a stiff wind that hit me and knocked me over. And I thought, well, wait a minute, that was not what I anticipated. But more times than not, saying yes, it's done a couple of things, I would say, in storytelling, Dean. One, it gives me an opportunity to experience something brand new and different. But two, I think it does something to the recipient of my yes. As I'm saying yes, and oftentimes I haven't thought about it in this way until you said what you were talking about, is that my yeses are I intend them to be unconditional. And I think just the way the world kind of operates now, it feels like there's always a condition that's attached, or it's an agenda. So translate that into the corporate world, or right, in sort of the lack of effective storytelling. There's always an agenda, and that's our North Star, when in fact that's backwards. And so I think that that's been a real key for me, is saying yes and doing so without anything attached to it at all. It's unconditional.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that's surprising to people. And if anything, to me, it's a bit of a sad statement on our society that people just don't say yes because why not? Or because I want to help, or because I might learn something, right? Like that's how we, I mean, that's for me, there are so many times I've said yes to something where you could say, Dean, you could say, Rod, I don't know why you're doing that. Like, what's in it for you?
What do you get out of this, right?
What's a tangible outcome? And it's like, does everything have to be that way? Because here's what I know. People will have said, Rod, you've done all these interviews. In the beginning, Dean, people would say, well, why don't you just focus on one demographic of guests, right? And I would, in the beginning, I mean, from day one, I mean, a lot of things that I've learned from them, but I'm so glad that I've stuck to this, which is, if I'm going to understand you, Dean, my ability to figure out and understand and hopefully platform your story comes from interviewing hundreds of parts of Dean, right? From other people in other parts of the world who have different types of jobs, levels of success, where they are in their own sort of chronology of growth and development as a human being, as a spouse, or just a community member. And if I had focused just on entrepreneurs or celebrities, you know, or teachers, or whatever it is, I think I would be missing out. I mean, I've been lucky that we don't live in sort of a 9-to-5 world, and that's been so gone. I don't think it sounds funny to even say 9-to-5. We don't live our lives like that.
Yeah.
And so that lends itself to, I might find something in the back of my mind as we're talking that reminds me of a grandmother in Tanzania that I interviewed in a very remote region through a translator, in the way in which there was an energy, there was something, right? And that stuff's hard to put on the paper, but man, I think of every one of these experiences I've had as an at-bat. Like, I'm a huge sports nut. I follow baseball because I'm a sports nut, but I'm not one to play baseball. I think it's too slow. But I like the notion of getting at-bats in life.
Yeah,
it's an at bat. A year ago, I'd never hosted a gala before. Even sounds weird to say it. I'm in Stockholm. I'm there to present on what we had seen in Tanzania through this amazing foundation. And less than 24 hours before this big gala in front of the elite of Stockholm. And if anybody knows of Sweden and the elite, like, that is saying something. And the host of the gala got into an accident and could not be the host. And I get this phone call, and it was like, we're asking you, but we're really not asking you. Right. And I said yes. And I left my hotel room. I met with the producers. They sent me to a tuck shop that had been there for, I don't know, 200 years, whatever it was, fitted me, boom, you know, and all of a sudden I'm hosting a gala for like,
wow,
6 hours straight. Jeez. Or something like that. And I only say that to say, because it's like, you want to get out there. You want to have an at bat. You know, it's like, I tell my son, you know, 13-year-old going through homework even before school starts on this project or whatever. It's like, look, It's not about finding the answer, right? It's about the process of that and the journey. And can you explain how you stair-stepped your way to where we are now with your project, right? He's writing a scene based on a book. Funny enough, it's a book about 1936 Berlin and the Olympics, right? I'm just so I'm a sucker for that. Like, sure, I'll help out with that. That sounds like fun. And but it's the at-bats, I think, in life. And it's not that everything has to be slick and perfect.
Yeah.
People love it when they're like, wow, you get it's the world's messy for you too, Dean. Like,
right.
When can we chat next?
And those yeses are the things that allow you to have options for more yeses. I mean, as soon as you start down the avenue of the no, well, it didn't give you any other opportunity. You literally just cut it off at the feet.
That's right. I remember there was a Sunday afternoon. I'd never been to Africa. I mean, in my head, I was always thinking, God, I want to somehow get to Africa someday. Again, going back to knowing my father had been there several times. And it's a Sunday afternoon and I get an email and I think, oh, that's spam. Like it just didn't, this can't be real, right? And it was a name that I recognized, a very well-known publicist who's this incredible person. I'd never met her. And I get this email and she was like, hey, we read some of the stories that you did about some of the different things that are going on in Africa. We'd love to, this NGO or whatever is trying to sort of get the word out on what's going on around child marriage and trying to support and uplift young women in Senegal. And I check it out. It's real. It's absolutely real. And I say yes. And I mean, within weeks, I'm getting my vaccinations and I'm being told by the doctor, why would you go? Like, I'm already like, I'm thinking, why wouldn't I go? Like, and I have the most incredible time. And I get the African fever that they talk about, which is just, you can't describe the energy. There's something about being on that continent.
At first in my head, I heard the vaccine didn't help you.
That's right. The yellow fever. No, yeah, not yellow fever, right? But no, this notion, it's called like African fever. Like you just, and when you, like I got connected to someone who's at MIT recently in the media lab, and she had spent time at the same refugee camp. And it's like, even through Zoom, you look at each, you know what you're trying to convey without even saying a word. Saying yes, taking a chance on people where there are no conditions and acknowledging like I was them at that point. I don't know where I am now, but they somewhat think that I have achieved something.
Yeah.
It all comes full circle. It all comes full circle. So you and I could chat now for the very first time in this interview. And in 2 years, we find ourselves with the potential to collaborate in something really powerful.
Sure.
Right. Those seeds get planted, right? So we're really farmers. We're all farmers. Yeah. Right? It's just when do things come to harvest? I don't know.
I think it speaks to when you put the level of commitment without, without the terms that could cancel, it also gives you the benefit of building that future, right? Because if you don't get that commitment to start off with, then we can't both be here in the present moment to have a good enough conversation that could turn into anything. It would just be our tad bit of shallow going back and forth for the camera, and then we're out, and there's no,
if we're on to the next
anyone. Yeah. What have you noticed? Because obviously you've had plenty of this kind of media now versus the in-person stuff. Have you felt it harder to get through with camera, or have you felt it almost easier?
It's not been harder. I'll say that. I don't know if it's easier. I would just say what's fascinating about it is you do have people. I mean, you have them within a confined space, if you really think about it. Right. Like we're confined to the four boxes within your right. What we're seeing from your camera and from mine, as opposed to, let's say, a large room or where other people are around, or if you're a celebrity, the handlers that you may have or publicist. Right. So it kind of reduces the noise.
Yeah.
And I think, look, you have a great voice. Obviously, I'm not the first to tell you that. But I think voice is really impactful in the way in which you can convey that. And these are some of the most basic things, but maybe the power of being in remote settings is if you develop a relationship with silence and pause, you start to understand the value in communicating in a way that is engaging, that provides an open sort of opportunity for whoever you're speaking with to share what they'd like to contribute, whether it's through a friendly sort of encounter or, it's work or professional.
Yeah.
So I don't mind it at all, to be honest. I mean, look, the benefit of in-person is picking up the energy in the room.
Yeah.
And understanding, wow, it's, you know, we're sharing in a room that we're sharing in a space, we're sharing a space that's incredibly hot under, you know, whatever it is. And you can kind of connect. So in that way, it can make it easier. But yeah, you do sometimes, I mean, there are countless stories. I'm looking at my, like when I interviewed Magic Johnson in Los Angeles, I mean, that, you know, that was sort of this epic, oh my gosh, he's larger than life, literally, to include his personality, right? He's just such an engaging guy that makes you feel like you're the only person in the room. But there are countless people in there. There are handlers. The energy that it starts off when he walks in, this one of the sound guys, you know, well-intentioned, like walks right up and starts to try to mic him up without even saying like hello or anything.
Yeah.
And I mean, the look on Magic's face, which I didn't, I would have been the same way. You know, you have to be, I mean, he can't go anywhere without being recognized.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, well, thanks, buddy, for way to set the mood, right? Meaning to the sound guy.
You have to talk with him after.
Yeah. Now I've got to figure out a way to sort of just let him know this is a safe space, right? We're just going to engage and have a conversation. And we did that. So in the moment, though, that's when it feels like you're either a singer on stage or an athlete where you better get in the zone quick. And if you do, it's an amazing ride. It's like, I just saw the movie F1 with Brad Pitt. And what I love about that is I got to go behind the scenes at Formula One, and Brad Pitt was there with Jerry Bruckheimer, and they were basically doing their intel for the movie. So it was this awesome sort of completing the circle where I'm standing in a room with Brad Pitt and all this crazy stuff and being behind the scenes of form and seeing it play out. But in that movie, he talks about this concept of flying, which is like being in the zone.
Yeah.
That sense where everything calms down. It's like you're a quarterback, right, in the pocket, and you don't hear the crowd. You see all the patterns sort of coming to the conclusion that you had, you know, coaches had drawn up. That zone and feeling like that with Magic was, I mean, it's a drug. It's an absolute drug. And it's about connection, though, right? And being, going back to your original point around that sort of where the curiosity, where did it come from? And it comes from, you know, those moments remind me very vividly, like, you know, it's like the voice in my head going, keep being curious, because you never know what you're going to get. And my opening question to him, by the way, there's this photo that one of the production folks took just randomly. And I just love this photo. I'm a diehard Detroit Pistons fan and grew up during the Bad Boy era. And so much so, and I write about it in the book, which I know we may talk about, but I wrote about how, you know, most kids put posters on the sides of their walls in their bedroom. I put posters and news clippings of my favorite teams in Detroit on my ceiling because the last thing I wanted to see at night was greatness. Yeah. That's the role they played in sort of pseudo parenting me or raising me around something's hard and you've overcome it kind of a thing. And so he crushed my dreams in 88. It's the famous phantom foul they called on Bill Laimbeer and allowed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to win it at the free throw line or whatever. And so in my head, after what happened with the sound guy, I thought, I just got to go. I'm going to take a risk here. And that's what I said. All right, we started and I said, all right, Magic, let's just sort of cut to the truth. That was not a foul. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the laugh that he has was captured in this photo I'm looking at behind my camera. And it's just such, for me, it's a reminder that we're all human beings. We've heard it a thousand times. And sometimes being okay, being, you know, sort of dented in life where you're not perfect, actually people like that.
Yeah.
It's refreshing. So, and the beauty about curiosity is I think it lends itself to that. It's like
absolutely
sort of perfect complement to the meal, right? It's that really great glass of red wine with your steak or whatever. You just kind of like, okay, that makes sense.
I find that is also, like, to me, the key of being present. Do you want to be present? Find a question and watch them for the answer.
Yeah.
Then I'm just here with you, right? I'm digging every story you have because I'm curious about what's going on with it. And I've got plenty other, but I'd love to jump right into the book right now.
Please.
Give me kind of a quick overview. Like, if someone's looking for this book, what questions get answered for me that I need to find?
So thank you for that. Let me sort of share how this came about. So again, being the dreamer that I am, I had written for Forbes for a number of years on different publications, and it was always like, okay, a book will be there at some point as a challenge, as if I think I'm going to run a marathon one day or, you know, throw myself in an Ironman, which I'm not doing either of those things. But
yet.
yet. Yeah, right. Now we've planted the seed in the universe.
Sorry.
And my sort of dreaming around that was that by September 2024, by my birthday in September, I would have submitted a proposal to several publishers, hoping, right, that of the thousands of submissions, that a guy who has my background would maybe get an extended look, right, yeah, and see if there could be a deal. Well, all of a sudden, I start getting, before my birthday, Wiley. I mean, they've been around since like 1807, the second largest publisher of business books in the world.
Wow.
One of their key people starts pinging me like on every social platform and shoots me an email. My stuff's public, and just says, "Hey, can we talk?" And I like, okay, sort of like taking that publicist, you know, call around going to Africa. And and he said, "Look, storytelling is like at the top of the list of what readers want. We want to have a book that, you know, is different, but talks about storytelling in our lives." And I quickly said, which probably I don't think will surprise you after our chat thus far, Dean, but I said, "Well, look, if you're looking for sort of the 7 steps to writing a better story or being a better storyteller, like I've enjoyed this Zoom, but I don't think I'm your guy." He was like, no. "We want you to do you. You do you." And that was very refreshing. And so he said, "Look, we have a global leadership call like on Monday." This was like a Thursday afternoon. Okay. He said, "Is there any way?" He said, "I'd love to bring this to the table on Monday." And it's Thursday afternoon, basically a wash, right? You've got kids and soccer and everything else. And he said, "Could you get me a proposal?" Sure. "Let me work on that." But the beauty is sometimes you need that pressure. You need that sort of the time that says, "Look, you either submit it or you don't." So that Saturday, I worked from literally ground zero and built a proposal and sent it on. And we had this, you know, it went very well, got it signed. And it ended up being like a 5-month turn between starting from nothing to completed manuscript. And I knew it was going to be brutal. I had heard from several friends who had been writers and just said, "Oh my God, we did it in less than 7 or 8 months, whatever, it's brutal." And I thought, yeah, I have less than that. And I've got the holiday swing. Like, this is a little bit crazy. And, you know how I approached it? I stressed over in the very beginning, like what format? Like, I have so many, sometimes you have too much, right? Like, how do I boil? I don't want to boil the ocean, but I want to be me.
Yeah.
And I thought back to as I was on the airplane and we were descending, getting ready to land in Dakar, Senegal, in the capital, right on the ocean. I'm looking down at a landscape that I had never seen before, right? It was like landing in a different world. And I just had for me, it was an epiphany where I just said, you know what? I am going to, every day I'm here, I'm going to write a journal and I'm just going to put it up on Facebook and social media, whatever. And it's going to be me. I'm not going to write for other people. I'm going to write my experience. And I got this fantastic response by doing that. I got like CEOs and different, I didn't even know that sent me notes like, "I know it's not like evening in Africa yet, but when are you going to post your next journal entry?" Right. And I was like, wow, I'm right. And so my writing has been described and that there's a rhythm to it, which I appreciate. Cause I do think in that way, like it's like jazz to me. And so I just said, don't forget that. Don't succumb, I guess, to the pressure of what you think it means to be an author.
Right.
And so I just sort of took off the training wheels for this book and said, if I'm not authentic, then it's going to fall flat and I will have cheated myself out of an opportunity to connect. Because my objective is the book does well enough that it provides opportunity for the next book that shows and tells stories about people that otherwise maybe wouldn't be able to get out there. So I take you, I share, there's a portion of it that is memoir. So every chapter is a different expression of what story is or it isn't, and or the challenges I've had along the way, from losing a business to giving a eulogy graveside, you get to read the eulogy, to an acceptance speech for Pangea's inaugural literacy award. I want people to understand that story is not a nice to have. It's not an accessory or a carry on to your life. It's with you everywhere you go. right? And so that's what the book is. So I basically, in any given chapter, I can take you to the refugee camp, swing you back to a camp in northern Michigan in the late 80s, you know, behind the scenes at Formula One, you know, in Rome with the Pope. And I did that intentionally. I want it to feel, and it's funny because I'm not a musician. I love music. I write to movie scores. I want to thank the movie Interstellar, and Cornfield Chase is one of my absolute favorites. I already listened to it this morning, and it played a huge role in my writing. I just on repeat.
Yeah.
But I think of the book, Dean, as it's sort of like, it's like an album, right? Like, Dean, this is your third album. And it's like, oh, wow. So Dean went with something that's like a very personal sort of album, right? It's not maybe what the execs wanted. It's him. Like, wow, right? Where each song, or in this case, each chapter, they stand alone as a song, but there's a theme. There's this sort of a thematic hook to it that connects them. So I say in the introduction, it's like, look, if you choose to pick it up and read chapter five first, great. Sure, you miss a couple of things in the beginning that might give you some context, but I intentionally wrote it so that, you know, and it's been, you talk about a humbling experience. I sent out copies of the book to be reviewed and to people that I've known loosely and some I know very well around the world. And the feedback's been really great. So that for me is everything, because it just says that I didn't write it for one group of people, a certain age group, you know, citizens of a certain country, none of that. But when I can send it to people in Australia, to Sweden, to Norway, to people in Africa and across the US, and universally they're pulling the same themes of what it did for them, then I feel like I have an album using that. I have an album that hopefully connects to people, but it's to challenge you, right? I ask people, it's like, look, if you're not in charge of your own narrative, you're not in control of it, then who is? And it's funny because when I've said that to people, it's like a question they've never asked themselves. Or they find that, well, wait a minute, I'm in control of my narrative, let's say in my personal life, but I know I'm not in my professional life, and sort of understanding that chasm in between.
Yeah.
Right. Stopping that elevator between two floors and asking those questions about what does that do? Like, what does it do to my own sense of self and spirit if I've yielded my control of my own story and narrative to a group, an organization, a community, a state, a set of laws or restrictions, right? I just think it opens that up. So it's, to me, it's a guide. The irony is Wiley now wants me to work on a companion guide that would come out Q1 to the book because of just the response we've gotten and how people see it. So
that's great. Congratulations.
It's a story in every chapter that weaves in and out, and you get to learn a lot about me, because I think I'd love it from an album's point of view, because if you do have more albums come out, people go, yeah, but I understand him because I read the first book.
So. Well, it's interesting because we started off our conversation where you told me I would have no clue how to explain to people if they asked me, could you write a book about how to live my life? Yet, this is a backseat to while you're driving through heavily important portions of your life that we get to view from your POV, basically. So it sounds like we got a little bit of a how-to.
Yeah, I think if people, I mean, that's the irony, right? I was on the, and I'm getting asked now, it's really, this is humbling. I've been asked by a university to speak, and they want books for these cohorts of graduate students, right? And it was interesting to hear this dean talk about what he took from the book already, like, you know, chapter one, chapter four, and chapter 10, like those, like, I almost want to put them like back to back to back, because they taught me this lesson around understanding my story within leadership, right? So yeah, look, I think it's all about intentionality. I think that if I had said, I am going to, in essence, tell you from on high that this is how to think about your story, it wouldn't work. You know, but if I've done it in a way where you are asking yourself those questions, or you are finding the questions that I pose to the reader, sort of eye-opening, then maybe you could step back and say, wow, this did help me think about my own story and the steps that maybe that I need to take to understand. You know, I use as a backdrop, I'll talk about like a school play, right? Because I think a lot of us can understand sort of what that is. It's, you know, are we playing the oak tree in the corner? right? Are we the lead character? And if we're not either one of those, or we are one of those, what's our story? Why are we playing that role? Maybe it's okay to play that role. Maybe it's perfectly appropriate. Like I know a really, really great individual in Stockholm who, in understanding his story, he knows, Dean, he's come to this point in his life and his own growth and development that he's really great being a number two. Like he hits it out of the park.
Yeah.
And I love that because it's, I think this notion, which feels very American, it's like, well, no, you have to be number one. Well, being number two in the context of what he does in his world professionally, there's nothing, he's not losing anything, right?
Yeah.
He is a part of the winning team and teams. And so I think it makes us then think differently about, well, who's in the audience? Are we leaning too far into the audience where we're missing the response? Or are we so distanced that we're getting ready to fall into the backdrop? You know, and so that's really the premise. I want you to ask great questions, but, and I do so by offering up the stories that have really sort of driven me or perplexed me.
Yeah. It seems like there's a bit of that self-exploration that you get to kind of tailor toward yourself after you get through a little pieces of this book. I like that.
Yeah. Aaron Rasmussen, he is a co-founder of Masterclass and someone that I just, of all my interviews, he's one of my top experiences, just selfishly for myself, just the sort of the ride he helped take me on in the interview, you know. And he had said to me, which is one of the greatest compliments I've ever gotten, he said, without me even asking, he just said, you know, a lot of people know, they see sort of the proverbial line in the sand, and most people will sort of avoid it.
Yeah.
Some will get close to the line, but then they'll back up. He said to me, he said, look, you cross that line, but you do so in a way where you extend your hand, and then we both cross back over that line, and it's an enjoyable experience. And so if that's like that, if anything, that to me is what I guess the essence of my mission with the book has been, is to do that, and then to not shortchange people and being sort of that guy. I can't, you know, we all know what that means to be that guy or that person.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be that at all, right? I mean, I'm still learning, right? The storytelling continues to evolve. You know,
the plane's not coming down.
It's not
taken off yet. We are still going on the runway.
We're still going. It's experiences like this with really thoughtful people like yourself that continue. It's like it puts more fuel into the plane.
Yeah.
Right? It's stocking up the luggage in a way where I think we can all learn. And so it's just an awesome opportunity to do so.
Dr. Rod, thank you so much. I'm going to have to try to get you back on here because these 30-minute conversations don't do anything for you and I. I felt like we just were like, oh, there's a drop in the bucket. Because I would love to keep going and dig a little deeper. We're having some good conversation here.
Happy to do so.
But yeah, we'll have to get you back on. Best place for people to find you?
Try to make it as simple as I can. DrRodBerger.com. The same for Instagram, LinkedIn. If you'd like, I'd love for folks to pre-order the book.
Yeah,
it's available wherever books are sold. I have a link on my website. You can go and, you know, wherever you want to go, Target, Walmart, Amazon, Barnes and Noble.
Get them everywhere.
Yeah. I'm learning a lot about about this side of a book, which is pretty fascinating and eye-opening. But if people follow, that'd be great on socials. And I will say, Dean, I do my very best. I don't know how you feel about this, but I try to answer people when they reach out because it's just,
absolutely,
I feel like it's a dying art, right? Of connection. Again, you never know. And so please shoot me a note and
that'd be great.
I'd love to, everybody makes me better in that regard. So I'm being selfish, right, Dean? But yeah, you can find me at drrodberger.com.
Selfish in a loving way.
That's right.
It's all about the intention. How do you word it?
That's right.
Well, thank you again. Like I said, we will chat about that, getting you back on. Everybody else, I hope you got all kinds of goodness from that because I did. And I will see you guys on the next one.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Partnerships for Profit. We hope you've gained valuable insights on how to form profitable partnerships and take your business to the next level. Be sure to subscribe and leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. Got a partnership story to share or someone you'd like to see featured on the show? Reach out to us. Until next time, keep building those partnerships for profit.